The favourite for the Derby ran, got soundly beaten, and then 20 minutes later was declared a non-runner. What on earth was going on? Welcome to the front page. It was a Derby day like no other. Relentless rain, a new free festival that the heavens did their best to drown out, and a stewarding decision that has split the sport down the middle. To discuss everything Epsom, I'm joined today by Maddie Playle and Peter Scargill, both of whom were at a soggy Epsom over the last few days. And we have got so much to talk about. We are going to start with the story which has gripped the sport since the moments after the Derby, when Benvenuto Cellini was sensationally declared a non-runner, having got his leg caught in the stalls. Now, bets on the favourite were refunded. Punters of the winners took a 25p rule 4. It has caused huge ructions in the sport, Maddie. Bookmakers have declared it an act of self-sabotage. Many punters are totally perplexed by it. The BHA have come out defending their stewards. Was it the right decision?
No, I think that's quite a simple answer for me. You've got the ruling right there. And if we go
we'll put it up on
quickly,
screen.
We'll yeah, a lot of it screen. Is about whether a horse is materially affected or not. And rather than blame the stewards for upholding a rule, I would blame the wording of the rule and the rule itself. Because in horse racing, we understand that a huge percentage of betting is luck, is fortune. It cannot be accounted for. And by my reading of the situation, it was the horse's fault that he got his leg caught up in the stalls. And therefore, you know, that is how can we then differentiate between a horse getting its rear leg caught up, a horse rearing, a horse stumbling after the start, you know, and the fact that Ryan Moore was asked for his riding plans after the event, the fact that it took 20 minutes to sort out, you know, this is, it shouldn't be relevant what Ryan Moore wanted to do. Oh, it was the plan to go forward. Well, of course he's going to say that if that's what's going to advantage his
plans
case.
Plans often go out the window as soon as the race begins.
Exactly. Yeah. You said it split the sport down the middle. I don't think it split it down the middle. I think it's just the BHA versus everyone else and those stewards. You know, in punting, in racing, we accept that bad luck happens. And I think this sets a really dangerous precedent that if you get a bit of bad luck happening, it is not your fault for placing that bet. It is not your responsibility to acknowledge when you take that bet. And that's not what happened on Saturday.
The thing I find so difficult about it is just to understand the logic of why they made him a non-runner. Because he obviously ran in the race and his chance was not so badly compromised or so obviously compromised that it was inconceivable that he could win from there. In the opening furlong, he was upside's Alderman, 100-1 rag, who ended up finishing fifth, five positions in front of Benvenuto Cellini. Had he won, he wouldn't have been declared a non-runner. Had he come second and won £400,000 in prize money, probably wouldn't have been declared a non-runner. Yeah. So where's
have
the
to think
line?
About his place in the market. If he wasn't a favourite, if all the money that hadn't been wagered on him and he was 150-1 rag, would anyone have said anything? You know, I'm sceptical of that. I'm also sceptical of the use of the stall's cameras in deciding this. Yeah. You know, they didn't have them over every stall, every race day.
Only two stalls were covered. Yeah.
Every race day in Britain does not benefit from that same technology. You know, are you now going to... I just think the whole thing is a really dangerous precedent. Mm. And fair enough if they implemented this rule down to the wording correctly, but is that rule being implemented correctly day in, day out in British racing? No, absolutely not.
Peter, you're well known for your contrarian instincts. Do you agree that the decision was wrong, or are you sitting alongside the BHA saying this was right?
I'm sitting here thinking there's a lot of self-righteousness on these sofas, frankly. Look, you know, the rule is a crappy rule, and I agree that it's too grey a rule to be implementing, right? So it's been introduced following the Harry Angel incident at Ascot, where Harry Angel, who was favourite for the, what was then the Golden Jubilee, maybe even one of the, it was some sort of anniversary jubilee, perhaps, had his leg up on the stalls, completely blew his chances in a sprint race, right? And that was quite apparent, you could say, that the horse should be worn out then. In terms of how the rule was applied on Saturday, I think they had every right to apply the rule, frankly. You talk about how he was alongside some 100-to-1 rag that came fifth.
Yeah.
Right? But he wasn't a 100-to-1 rag, he was the favourite. So if he wasn't, well, he wasn't being ridden.
If the 100-to-1 rag can come from dead last, it's not like he missed the break by far. You know, nobody was at the start of the race going, oh, Benvenuto Cellini's had a terrible start.
No, but it was mentioned on the commentary, and he was near enough with Jamie Spencer.
He missed the break. Horses missed the break every single day.
He missed the break because his leg was on the stalls, Tom.
True.
Now we say, if you're coming out of the stalls alongside Jamie Spencer, not many people look to be with Jamie Spencer coming out of the stalls, do they? Let's be frank. A man who likes to hang out the back. So I think the rule is not a good rule. I think the application of the rule was perfectly adequate.
Do you think it is day to day in British racing?
But that's what about. We're not talking about that. We're talking about specific.
But no, but
the
consistency does matter,
yeah,
doesn't
it? Does.
Because horses lose their chance at the start every single day of the year. I mean, in jumps racing, it's absolutely rife. Mm-hmm. How many times do people see their horses go 5 lengths behind the rest because of starters?
But how many times do people then come on and say they want justice refunds for stuff? I don't think people often do.
I think they complain about the start. They don't say they want justice refunds.
No,
really.
I think they complain about the jockeyship, if anything, which is a separate issue.
I mean, I'd be inclined, if people could adopt a grown-up, sensible position like Richard Birch put forward in today's paper and on the website, whereby you say, damn it, misfortune on our part.
Which I think most punters do.
Then you could strip out the rule and it could be misfortune. I think that the rule's in place and has been applied means that if the rule is now reversed and something like this happens, you'll have people belly aching saying that, you know, punters aren't looked after and, you know, we should be getting refunds and all. People are entitled. Yeah, but
you're subject to a rule 4. I mean,
I think that's it exactly.
It takes 20 minutes to figure this out as well.
I have an issue with that as well. I have an issue with the fact that they have to get the tactics after the race, so they have nothing to compare it to. And they can all come out and say, yeah, we want it to be handy. And given how people were racing at Epsom, you did want to be handy, right? And
I'm sure it's totally irrelevant, isn't it?
It's not helpful to reach a conclusion.
You need to be asking those questions before
the race. To have something to refer it to. But I don't think they were wrong to apply the rule. I think the rule is wrong in being there. It can't be taken away.
Rules certainly can be taken away. Let's come to the rule, and we'll put rule 86 up on screen now again, so people at home can see it. I mean, I'll. What it reads is, the stewards may declare a horse a non-runner where, in a race started from starting holes, a horse is denied a fair start and its chances are materially affected, including but not limited to where a horse is prevented from starting on equal terms due to the faulty action of the starting gates. So that's what it says. So there's two judgment calls stacked there. It says, first of all, the stewards may act where a horse is denied a fair start and its chances are materially affected. So basically, the stewards are given the option of starting, of acting, if they judge that a horse's chances were materially affected. I mean, it's so vague. There's so much subjectivity in there. This is the biggest flat race of the year.
That's another thing as well. I mean, I was out and preoccupied, so I couldn't actually watch the race. Like a few minutes afterwards, I watched the final finishing clip and I saw Benvenuto Cellini even through the driving rain in his green Peter Brandt silks. And I was like, oh, so he's beaten in the Derby. And then I get the message saying, Benvenuto Cellini's been made a non-runner in the Derby. And I'm like, sure, I just saw him finish the race. I think these sort of decisions just paint the sport in a really amateurish light, to be honest. You know, they're hard for us to get our head round as people who follow the sport day in, day out. What is someone who, you know, especially this year with the Derby wanting to attract more attention and be brought back to its former glory, what are other people going to think?
Yeah, and that therein lies one of the questions, because this rule was brought in out of the Harry Angel instance at Royal Ascot, but also to bring British racing into line with international standards and the sort of world pool implications there, I think, are also notable, because some of our colleagues with experience racing internationally have sort of said, if this was in Australia or Hong Kong or something, the bookies or punters would have been braying for this to be a non-runner.
So you've got little man syndrome in the sense you're only focusing on Britain, whereas I have an internationalist outlook. So clearly my perspective is right on this one. It's effectively what you're saying, Tom.
I think what I'm saying is that it's not exactly what I'm saying, Pete.
Okay. But that was my interpretation of it.
You, like the stewards at Epton, have come to an interesting interpretation. But I think the point I'm saying is that the rule came in to bring Britain into line with international jurisdictions. But what we're seeing here is that the instincts of British punters actually are very different. And it's actually a view that, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, caveat emptor, buyer beware. You take your chances, you run your race, and if you don't get the luck of the draw, then you just have to accept
it. Another interesting point I thought brought up was Friendly Soul. When she stood in that hole at Haydock the other week, she wasn't declared a non-runner.
That's not got to do with a start, Manny. This is what about her. This is people being entitled to say, oh, well, what about that? And what about this? And I want my money back.
Like, I don't think so. I think it's questioning the consistency of the application of the rule.
And this is it. This is the sort of the can of worms argument. And you know, when you look at the rest of the rule, including the how it's applied to jumps racing, it becomes even worse because it becomes so subjective that probably dozens of horses every single day could be declared non-runners because they've not had a fair start.
Oh, look at the Cheltenham Festival and all the false starts at Cheltenham. Yeah.
So what happens? Does the rule remain? Should the rule change? Because that's ultimately what's at stake here.
I think the wording of the rule could be changed to make it more clear and easier to implement. It's not an easy rule to implement.
You kind of have a situation where people are waiting 20 minutes to find out the result after a race. It was chaos in the ring.
Yeah.
It was chaos afterwards. Caused all sorts of issues for bit most people who'd lost their slips, torn their slips up in the interim. Effect to turnover on the next race. So, you know, you can't have a situation where the status quo remains, right? They need to look at that and make it black and white, effectively.
Yeah.
Or they scrap the rule.
Okay. Let's move on to perhaps other big talking point of the weekend, particularly off the track, which was the efforts to reinvigorate the Derby, particularly on the hill. And I suppose what we can say to the Jockey Club is that they tried. They certainly tried. They put a bunch of money into it. They put on a new music festival. They got a community zone. They got lots of red buses there, big screens, free entry for kids. And then it rained relentlessly and no one turned up. It was sad to see. So I think our own Lee Morrishead has argued that it's still a net win. Like, they did the right thing and they were just unlucky. Do you subscribe to that view, Pete?
Yeah. I don't think you can say that. Now, last year was just wretched. The weather was wretched.
I looked at this, actually. Since 2021, the weather for the Derby has basically been bad every single year. Like, the best they've had is sort of like cool and dry. They've been so unlucky with the weather.
So, yeah, that last year, they had to do something after last year, right? And they have tried, and the principles were there, but I cannot begin to tell you how awful it was there on Saturday. It was cold, it was wet, it was horizontal rain. If you've paid to come, you were coming. It was reasonably busy in the stands, mostly in the stands, but, you know, the people's umbrellas were going up, they were getting buffeted everywhere, falling over on manhole covers and all this kind of stuff. It was genuinely horrible, right? So why would you go up onto the hill even if it was free?
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't possibly go up there. So it did make me think, like, when Gordon Strachan when he was manager of the Great Southampton Football Club, when they moved to St Mary's from the Dell, they started really badly at St Mary's. And Gordon Strachan was approached by a white witch who said that the reason they're playing badly here is because they built on an ancient burial ground. And they had an exorcism. And after that, Southampton won loads of games. So I think if next year's not regular for the Jockey Club, or maybe even now, Jim Allen needs to get on the phone,
so what
get someone
saying?
Down there, and get rid of the spirits that are haunting the
Derby. Do you think Epsom is cursed?
I am thinking that we have to consider it, Tom. Because I come, you know, after all the effort they put in, and the week we had before the Derby, in terms of
I think
of
it's
weather,
turned out that one of those fortune tellers on the hill has been... barred from entry.
But I don't. How can you be so unlucky?
It is unlucky.
Put so
it?
Much effort into
but
it.
But hold on. Well, here's the thing. Like, so the Friday.
You say that, but Friday was.
Yeah, this is the point I was going to make.
Okay.
So there was a series of tweets by a bookmaker called Adam Swan. I don't know if you saw these. Who sort of live tweeted his experience on the hill over Friday and Saturday with a sort of like a grim. A black humour to it, as he sort of showed a series of pictures of various bands playing to, you know, quite literally one man and his dog talking about taking 2-3 bets on a race and them all coming from one single family, you know, and that was the Friday. So the Saturday, the weather was terrible, but the Friday, the weather was okay.
Yep.
Not sunny, so that's not going to help, but it still didn't get.
You can't, I'm not saying this is Epsom's fault whatsoever, but you can't design an event to only be successful when the weather is in your favour. There were lots of success. You know, it seems it wouldn't be my bag, but the O Beach thing went down pretty well. I was in the betting ring on Friday. It was absolutely packed full of young people who were enjoying a day out of the races.
Really young crowd.
You know, they had various enclosures sold out. I saw the efforts that they put in with the community. I live in Epsom and you walk around and there was a competition about storefronts. There was sort of, what do you call it, yarn bombs and things like that, all sorts of newfangled initiatives. So you've got to praise them for trying. I was given access to the site last Tuesday and sort of taken around and shown all the things that they'd done, including the bleacher style sort of standings. They were really cool as well, managed to get up there for a race. I think it's going to take time, isn't it? They've said it's a 5-year plan. They'll have learned lessons from this first year. To me, it was just amazing. Look, this is what 6 million quid can do. You know, we saw that. I don't really understand why there weren't more people on the hill on Friday. I really don't. And I think we need to think about that. Obviously, on Saturday, when people are registering interest and it's howling a gale outside, you're not going to turn up. But on Friday, when the weather is fine and it's all absolutely free and you can see a concert effectively, you know, some decent bands, I don't get why that it was so barren. I wonder if sort of racing needs to look at how it approaches these music nights, maybe. I mean, when you had the O Beach Ibiza, not only was that more sheltered, it was aimed at a very specific demographic with, you know, specific interests, whereas maybe the days of sort of trying to cater to a sort of older school audience, maybe it needs freshening up in a way. But I certainly can't I can't say that Epsom did anything wrong.
Yeah, that is an interesting underlying question. You have to go back sort of 20 years, 15 years, and you can see 100,000 people on the hill absolutely swarming with people. Maybe that is just, those days are just gone and actually people would rather be the other side. They'd like you, I'm sure, Pete, would rather go to the Ibiza beach and have
all
that experience.
Anyone could do to drag me away from it, sadly.
Well, let's move to the racing because while the track was a bit soggy, if you strip away the controversy, we still had some fantastic racing, some really interesting winners and some great stories. We have to start with the Derby. A 50th British classic for Aidan O'Brien when his third string, or maybe fourth string, Christmas Day won Epsom in the Derby. It was his 12th Derby as well and his fourth in a row. Quite extraordinary. Is that domination or weakness for the Derby, Pete?
Well, it's domination and it's an operation that puts so much of their efforts into producing horses to exceed and excel at Epsom still. I mean, as I have already stated, it was really quite foul at Epsom on Saturday. So I didn't really see any horses in the paddock. Frankly, I didn't really see the race very well. It was only later on. So my wife, Tina, said that she felt, having watched it, that the winner, Christmas Day, sort of handled the prelims very well. He was sort of the most calm, cool, calm friend. He was very calm afterwards as well. So perhaps there was an element of, you know, the horse who handled the circumstances best on the day winning the race this time around. But, you know, the contrast of the continued excellence, particularly this year, of Aidan O'Brien, Ballydoyle against, you know, no Godolphin representation, two very poor efforts in the race for Kia Jurabchin's horses after all that big spending, you know, real key racer, and they didn't run very well. No Wathnam involved. Item ran poorly in the Derby. You know, it's amazing how they, even with all the strength and depth they have, that they turn up and they perform year in, year out. You can't hold that against them. It's the standard that everyone else needs to get to, I'd argue.
You certainly can't hold it against them. It's undeniably excellence of the highest order. What Aidan O'Brien does, what Ballydoyle do, is extraordinary. He's rewriting the rec books and will almost certainly never be matched. But what does it say when the third/fourth string from Ballydoyle wins the Derby? It's their fourth in a row.
I mean, it was there to be seen. He'd won the Ballysacks, he'd won the trial, and they finished in a similar order. You know, that form's working out all right. He just, like Pete touched one, for me, he looked very straightforward, very uncomplicated, quite a powerful horse, well-built horse. I like the way he was very straight, wasn't it, the middle of the track as well. There was no deviation from his line. I think it's just indicative of where the industry is at. And you say, you know, it is a remarkable achievement by Ballydoyle, but ultimately it is that way because they have the backing of Coolmore, and Coolmore have prioritised breeding horses for this kind of race. And I don't think anyone else has in a similar way, perhaps Judmont, but still their focus is slightly different. And I think that's just borne out, as well as, obviously, he's a magnificent trainer and he is backed by an army of incredibly experienced, talented people who work really hard.
Yeah, and a word for Ronan Whelan. He rode the winner, the biggest winner of his career, one of many sort of lower profile jockeys who have had incredible moments thanks to Ballydoyle's strength and depth. You touched on one horse that I want to mention here as well, because this just illustrates just how hard it is to challenge Ballydoyle. Poker, one of the two Ammo horses, 4.3 million guineas, which in pounds is
lots,
but 4.5 million. Yeah. Sent off 80-1, trailed in stone last.
Yeah.
I mean, geez, oh, the probably most expensive horse in the race, you'd say.
Comfortably.
So, yeah. Gotta be. Comfortably. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Finished behind everything. I mean, doesn't that just say it all?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it shows you, even with the ambition and, you know, deep reserves that Kier Drabjan and his pals have called on to try and get involved, you end up going to the Derby with your £4.5 million horse and, you know, going away with your tail between your legs, don't you? So it shows you the strength, like you say, the strength that Ballydoyle have and the difficulty in breaking into that. But yeah, that was, I imagine, quite a chasing the Derby day for Ammo Racing, really.
Yeah.
Those two, you know, a lot of talk in the build-up about ancient Egypt, and he didn't really do anything either, so not a great day. I'd say Ascot's really quite important for them in this big project of his now. Really, yeah. Really important.
Dolphin, though, as well. You know, Charlie Appleby hadn't had a runner, I believe, until on Oaks Day for over a week, and that was at Doncaster on the Friday night.
Something like.
So, yeah, where is Godolphin's firepower this season? Quite alarming, that.
Yeah. Another sort of disappointing performance on Derby Day with Calandigan, the world's top rated horse. Francis Graffard was very blunt in the aftermath, said, "I shouldn't have run him. The ground is wrong." I think potentially Epsom is wrong for Calandigan, because he also was beaten in the same race last year when coming with a challenge that looked like he was going to easily win. Bay City Roller got it for George Scott, though, a first domestic Group 1 for him. Loved the ground. As George Scott, kudos to George Scott, he told everyone beforehand, the quote in the Racing Post was, "I hope when we arrive there, the rain is hammering down on
the
car."
I think it was the only one with those sentiments.
And it still went off 17-2. It was 12-1 half an hour before the race. So it won by a mile.
Yeah, not a great spectacle, but I mean, horses have to handle these conditions. That's why Christmas Day will be down as a Derby winner. That's why Bay City Roller is now a domestic Group 1 winner, because, you know, you have to play on the field that is there, and they did that.
It's a remarkable turnaround as well. Just from, I mean, George Scott was a man almost down and out a few years ago, not going, had, you know, issues with his personal life, wasn't going great with his runners. he changed his approach. He found this horse, Rocket Rodney. He brought Bill O'Gorman into the fold. And at that point, he's built this relationship with Sheikh Nasser of Bahrain. And now he's really hitting these big races consistently. So credit to him and his team to turning around and being there, winning Creep Ones on the big days. And hey, this is a horse you're going to target the arc with now. I mean, yeah. He wouldn't have thought that 5 years ago when he was on his uppers.
Great day for George Scott. Also a great festival for Joseph O'Brien, Aidan's son, yeah. Who goes from strength to strength. I mean, you're getting to the point where sort of Joseph is actually one of the biggest rivals to Ballydoyle, thundering on a very good win of the Oaks and a fantastic day for Dylan Brown at Monaghan as well.
Yeah, Joseph, I mean, obviously the first thing anyone ever says is, oh, well, he's Aidan's son and that's a considerable leg up and all the rest of it. But if you look into who owns his horses, it's not like he's getting loads of of Coolmore or Ballydoyle cast-offs. And he's built this empire purely on his own. You only have to look at what he achieved during the jump season. I think it was 5 grade ones. He doesn't even consider himself a jumps trainer. He's won some of the biggest races all over the globe. I think he deserves an enormous amount of credit for sort of so quickly as well, creating such a strong name for himself in his own right. And the filly thundering on was spectacular. Have you ever seen a rider sit that still at that stage in an Oaks when he's, what, 22, 23? I think he might be 23, Dylan Brown at Monaghan.
But he's been riding, he's been preparing for this. I mean, the video on YouTube of him riding in the Dingle Derby when he's sort of about 6 years old or something.
And
like
you'd imagine in a few years he will be the new Ballydoyle number one, wouldn't you? I think he'd probably be a short price for that job. But look, she was clearly the best filly in the race. I think what she achieved was pretty spectacular to come from where she did. You know, we were talking about earlier how you wanted to be prominent at Epsom. Well, she was right out the back and it didn't seem to make a difference to her. Legacy Link ran a solid race and it was just a really, really good story. And good to see a new owner there as well. I did a little bit of digging around his sort of background and him and his father and their family are incredibly, incredibly wealthy, the Mysteries. But of course, Thundering On's dam, Thundering Nights, they sadly lost. So what a way to have, it's got a bit of the George Washington's about it, hasn't it? What a way to have one foal and then create a legacy. Quite remarkable.
Tremendous story. Final angle to explore from Epsom is the rides, the jockeys, because Epsom, of course, is such a challenging course to ride at the best of times. But when the rain is coming down and nobody knows which side is the place to be, it becomes a guessing game to a certain extent. I want to, start with Laura Pearson, because what a story this is. She broke her neck at Epsom in a fall. And came back, I think it was in 2022, and came back to win the Group 3 Princess Elizabeth on Sparks Fly. But she didn't just win it, she was the only jockey with the courage to not come over to the stand side, as everyone had been doing for the entire meeting, but to go down the rail. She rode them to sleep and took the Group 3 glory. What a story that was.
Yeah, the terrific ride and somebody backing their judgment.
Yeah,
I mean, Sparks Fly loves bottomless ground. So presumably the bit on the inside was the wettest.
Yeah.
So in theory, that's the shortest way around. That was a logical thing to do. But it still takes guts to do it when everybody else is coming across to the other side. You've got to judge it. You've got to see where you are. And the race finished and she went off to the winner's coach. And I always had the double take when they said the winning distance was 8.5 lengths or something dark by that. I mean, she was brilliant and it was a great performance. I by sheer coincidence, have to stand next to the owner and the people connected with the horse. They were screaming the place down. It was a really lovely story. And so fair play to Laura for having sticking to her guns, basically. It was really real sharp piece of riding.
It was. And I think also it shows what happens when jockeys are allowed to build up a rapport with a horse. I mean, she won big races on Sparks Fly, mainly in France. But how many other owners, trainers, when it came to a big day, would have gone, actually, we're going to go for a Ryan Moore, William Buick, whatever. And to stick, not just on Saturday, but throughout the horse's whole career with Laura, you know, they got the rewards for that. And I think it really speaks to how well jockeys can understand horses. I mean, she was saying in great detail about how earlier on in Sparksfly's career, she was a lot hotter to handle. And she knew, she had that prior knowledge that she was quite happy to race on her own. She didn't need competition. And also that she spoke to her good friend Ross Ryan beforehand, and Ross said, go up the middle. And she said, yeah, yeah, sure. And then went up the inside. And I think, you know, to do that with so much against you and not being a senior figure in the weighing room takes an incredible amount of gall and determination.
Imagine you get it wrong, you know, and then you look like you've completely mucked it up.
And
you know?
Jockeys have to be prepared to make those decisions. But how easier must it be to stick with the crowd and go, race just didn't plan out for her, she wasn't good enough, rather than, you know, if she loses, on your head be it if you go to the stand side. So I thought it was a wonderful story, really invigorating piece of riding.
It was great. One who did go up the middle was Ocean Murphy, which on Bay City Roller in the Coronation Cup. But that also was kind of, you know, a move that hadn't been sort of widely deployed. Now, Bay City Roller loves soft ground, but went up the middle. Yes. My sort of response to your argument about liking soft ground is they're not just like a relative thing. Like they like it more than other horses. They're still better not running in a bog, if possible.
Yes, it might be the sense that some horses are better able to handle it, shall we say. Mm. But we're moving into the grey here, Tom, and we've decided earlier in the show that we don't like grey areas.
Yes.
So I'm not going to dwell on the grey.
We don't like nuance in the show.
Exactly. So actually, Murphy said that he explained his logic at the racecourse on Saturday. He said he thought it would be too wet, ironically, on the inside. The stand side was too chewed up. So I'm going to go down the middle. So there's a combination of that and the horse being better suited to soft ground and Francis Graffard cursing himself like no one I've ever seen with Caland again. So, I mean, hopefully he's going to come back and is he going to run a Royal Ascot? Was that the plan or is he not going to run now? Anyway, hope to see Caland again on better ground soon is how I'm going to finish this sentence.
Tremendous. Let's finish with ride of the weekend. Pearson for bravery and backstory, Murphy for conviction, Dylan Brown McMonagall for the ice and the oaks, or someone else entirely, Maddie?
Got to be Laura Pearson. Yeah, I thought it was just very individual of her to go and do what she did, and no one had really explored other parts of the track at that point, so they were following her lead as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, Manu has a good point, but it's wrong. Dylan Brown McMonagall rode the best race of the entire meeting on Thundering On. It was sublime to watch him come through and have the confidence to sit there. You half think sometimes when, particularly on soft ground, when jockeys are sitting there, this horse isn't going to find anything. It's going to be a real thrash out to the end. But he sat and he waited and he kept clear. It was brilliant. He has excelled. You know, he was brilliant in Saudi Arabia when I was out there earlier. He did fantastically in Hong Kong.
Really well in Hong Kong.
You know, not a lot of jockeys do well when they go to Hong Kong straight off the bat. You'd know better than I would. Mm. He is an exceptionally talented jockey, and that ride exemplified it. It was really, really good to watch.
Good note to finish on. Thank you very much to both of you. What a Derby meeting. Plenty of talking points, and it was a pleasure to chew them over with you. Nuance avoided successfully. Thank you very much to you at home for joining us as well. We'll be back again next week with more debate and news and all the big issues in racing. And until then, goodbye.